The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Got like 10 things going on here. Got, so QuickTime's going. I just adjusted the Zoom volume and I'm downloading.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to watch this Philip K. Dick movie while I'm waiting for you. Oh, the video. The uploader has not made this video available in your country. I love this show. Oh, they show me an ad.
That always comes through. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen like streaming stuff where the stream of the actual content you want to watch is kind of janky. But boy, oh boy, is every single ad is at full, you know, 4K quality.
Welcome to Spotcast, episode 6. My name is Tim Mitra, and I'm in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And we're also graced with the presence of Jonathan Kuhlein in Mississauga, Ontario.
I'm back!
Our fact checker extraordinaire. Alrighty then. So do you want to, let's do some fact checking, Jonathan. How do you feel about that? We'll do episode 3 from Spotcast?
Absolutely. We'll dive right into our clarifications and corrections, and maybe a little criticism here and there. 9 minutes in to episode 3, Diana Muldaur played Catherine Pulaski, Dr. Catherine Pulaski on Star Trek The Next Generation. Discussion about her name in the episode.
Yeah.
13-14, Alicia Vikander won the 2016 Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for her performance in The Danish Girl. I think you guys maybe thought she was for Ex Machina.
We weren't sure. Yeah.
17-30, The Punisher was introduced to the Marvel Cinematic Universe in season 2 of the Daredevil TV series on Netflix and was the main focus of that story. So he was definitely front and center there. Mm-hmm. 1738, John Bernthal is the star of The Punisher, and he also played Shane on the first 2 seasons of The Walking Dead.
So he was that guy from The Walking Dead.
He was that guy from The Walking Dead, absolutely. 2218, the competing Volcano movies both hit theaters in 1997. They were Dante's Peak, starring Pierce Brosnan, and Volcano, starring Tommy Lee Jones.
All right.
Both of them clearly made an impression on both of you. 2710, The Naked Sun is the second book of Isaac Asimov's Robot Trilogy, published in 1957. Tim was couldn't quite pull that one out of his magic hat. 2806, Jason Isaacs plays the captain on Star Trek Discovery. I'm sure you guys have that one locked in by now. Mm-hmm. 2943, the original Star Trek TV series aired for 3 seasons before being canceled. Season 1 had 29 episodes, season 2 had 26, and season 3 had 24, for a total of 79, or 80 if you count the double episode as 2 parts, a debate which can incite nerds to brawl at a Trek convention. 3719, Marina Baccarin, one of the stars of Firefly, went on to star in the reboot of V. She was on Homeland and Gotham, and she, of course, was Deadpool's girlfriend in Deadpool. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. 4021, Cersei Lannister from Game of Thrones is played by Lena Headey. She also starred in Terminator the Sarah Connor Chronicles. 4344, Justin Long played Brandon in Galaxy Quest. That's
the Mac guy.
Yeah. He was one of the mega fans who helped save the day. He also starred in a series of commercials for Apple, and he was also in Kevin Smith's really bizarre but compelling film Tusk,
which I still haven't seen yet,
wherein he is dressed up as a human walrus. Very weird but actually surprisingly entertaining film. 4423, documentary directed by Leonard Nimoy's son Adam is called For the Love of Spock, and it's on Netflix now, I believe.
Yep.
4650, Galaxy Quest made about $90 million at the box office of a budget of $45 million and scored 90 on Rotten Tomatoes. So by any measure, a pretty successful flick. 116.33. What? And if you own a copy of a movie you love, then they can't change it on you. It's yours until the playback device snuffs it. You guys were talking about whether or not it was good to own something or, you know, or whether you could download it, or, you know, if people going back and making changes like Mr. Spielberg, Mr. Lucas, going back and changing films. Of course, my view is that I have the original Star Trek. So you have the original Star Wars. We try and hold on to these things because you just never know what's going to happen.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But and that said, I mean, like, I have to eat my own hat because I did say last week that the director's cut of Blade Runner is probably the best version that I've seen so far, right?
That's true. It's true.
Yeah. And actually, Jaime sort of mentioned that there's like 17 versions of Blade Runner. And it's interesting because one of the versions of Blade Runner that is on the disc set that you have is the what they call the European or German release. And as Carol explained it to me, and I think this is in the director's cut too, is the part where Rutger Hauer's character is squishing the guy who made the
Tyrell,
Mr. Tyrell's head. On the American one, you just see him like squishing the head, but on the German version, you see spoilers. You see the his thumbs going into the guy's eyes and blood pouring out. Right, so because you know they as Carol said, they need to see that stuff in over there to make it worthwhile. Anywho, alrighty. Well, it leads us into our follow-up, which is actually about Blade Runner. We're not going to try and so Jaime hasn't seen Blade Runner, as we established before mm-hmm. before we started recording. But Jonathan and I both went last Thursday, the day before it officially opened, and saw it Blade Runner 2049. And so I wrote down here in terms of my notes. It's a long movie. It was a lot longer than I thought it was going to be. I just kept looking at my watch, going, "Is this still going on?" And I think it will require multiple viewings, at least for me anyway. I found it to be implausible central plot, but they made it plausible, if you can follow that logic, right? And it kind of leaves some loose ends that could lead to possibly a future sequel movie or even a TV spinoff, you know, the Planet of the Apes movie that came to TV for a few weeks. and it had, if you're a fan of the show, it sort of did have some throwbacks to a lot of reflections of the original movie. But we were also talking before the podcast recording that I do think it stands on its own, like as a movie. If you have not seen the original movie, I don't think the original movie is required viewing to really sort of enjoy this movie. It's quite good from that point of view. Visually stunning. You know, the soundtrack, I think the original soundtrack from the original movie was far better, but I'm not sure. Was this one done by, this wasn't done by Vangelis' soundtrack, Jonathan?
You know what? I will double check that while we have our conversation.
All right. And I found that it's funny, in the trailer, Mackenzie Davis, who stars in, she was in The Martian, and she was also in A Halt and Catch Fire. She plays one of the main characters there, who has a name, but I can't remember. But anyway, so she is, in my mind, very reflective of Daryl Hannah. When I first saw the trailer, I had to go back and go, "Ooh, wait, was that Daryl Hannah?" Because Daryl Hannah's character is doesn't survive the first movie. So, but very interesting that they chose an actor who looks very much like her at that point in her career as well, right? So,
I'm guessing you're talking about Cameron from Halt and Catch Fire. Yeah, because the other main character it could have been was Donna, but given that description of Daryl Hannah, I would guess Cameron.
Well, Mackenzie Davis is her name. She's a Canadian actress, of course, and she's a key character in The Martian too. She's the computer geek that figures things out. So this, at least she didn't play a computer geek in this movie. Oh, is that a spoiler? I don't know. Help me now. Okay. Yeah. Some interesting things. What do you think, Jonathan, without trying to spoil the movie for Jaime?
Yeah, I agree with pretty much everything you said there. I mean, I think, you know, these are no-win situations for any filmmaker. I mean, you know, how do you follow something that's so iconic in science fiction? I mean, this movie in 1982 led to so many iterations of that dystopian, dark, you know, noir sci-fi genre. You know, it really was a seminal film. And to go back, you know, 35 years later and tackle it, you're in for a really tough time. But that being said, I think, you know, choosing yet another Canadian, Denis Arcand, to do this, you know, somebody who has a vision. I mean, we saw that with Arrival last year, a really terrific film. I found those two films to be very alike in that it's moody, its pace is really measured. You know, so many science fiction movies now, especially because because of the constraints of time, are so bombastic. There's so much going on. They're, you know, they're hooking you. They're taking you for a ride. This movie was so slow and staid and really just built itself up. It took its time through scenes. They let the visuals tell the story. There was long pauses with no dialogue that really just let you soak it all in. I found it really compelling. I enjoyed it. I think more than I went in with the same feeling I go into anytime they bring anything back. When they bring back, you know, Star Wars or Star Trek or anything else, I go in with a really apprehensive, oh, I really hope they don't screw this up. And they didn't, in my opinion. I think this was great.
Yeah, and coming back to what you said about Ridley Scott, I mean, I think that he had done Alien just before this, or a few movies before this, right? And Aliens, where he sort of established a really sort of dark, you know, haunting sort of horror style of sci-fi. You know, before that, everything sci-fi was clean and polished and there was no dust and, you know, like there were no Roombas running around either, but somebody was polishing things while people were sleeping. Whereas Alien, I think, was one of the first movies where everything was kind of like broken down. And I mean, and Star Wars to a certain extent was like that too, right? Everything was broken down and dusty and dirty and, you know, steam coming out of things that shouldn't be coming out of. And so he established that thing. And if you haven't seen Blade Runner, you have seen Blade Runner from the point of look and feel and emotion emotion as you get from a scene, because that kind of vision has been reflected in a lot of other sci-fi movies. Like I can think of Killjoys or Dark Matter.
Fifth Element.
You know, shows like that have, Fifth Element is another one, yeah, where everything's kind of like, it's kind of like Metropolis and technology and dirt and filth and grime and all that sort of thrown into one place. And it all came from that original movie, Blade Runner, you know, with the constant rain and really sets the atmosphere. And Denny Arcand has reflected that sensibility and taken it up a notch, I think, actually, in successfully too, in the new Blade Runner 2049 as well. So,
and sorry, I've got your details for you here. Hans Zimmer and Benjamin Walfish made the soundtrack for this.
Okay.
Zimmer, right. Of course, he's been doing iconic film soundtracks for a few years now. So.
Right. So moving on, just a couple of other follow-up items here. I posted, this is following up to Jaime's post about the film noir of Blade Runner, or it's being compared to film noir movies from last week from episode 5. I was reminded when he showed that to me, or when I watched it, that there's a guy I've been following on YouTube called Nerd Writer 1. His name is Evan Hushchak. But he does these little essays, kind of Ken Burns-esque kind of, what's the name of that guy? Oh man, Canadian guy again. He does all the interesting books. Really fuzzy afro hair guy.
Malcolm Gladwell,
thank you. Very reminiscent of Malcolm Gladwell's sort of narrative style. He breaks down things. And I don't think it was the Blade Runner movie per se that first got me into the Nerd Writer, but he breaks down like, how does Steely Dan write a song? How does, you know, the Rolling Stones make him, you know, do this? What is Blade Runner reflective of modern society or future societies? And like that. They're really, really good to watch. And I really recommend that you check out Nerd Writer 1, and specifically this one if you're into Blade Runner. But just, you can pick just about any one of his videos and just watch it. And it's like, you know, it's like a 5 to 10 minute essay on something. And they're not always about movies. They're not always about, you know, books or whatever, but it's kind of interesting stuff. Right. So, and just one real quick one here, we talked about the director's cut, and it's interesting. I was reading through some notes, probably in IMDb, that the term director's cut was actually invented to describe Ridley Scott's redo in 1992 of Blade Runner from 1982. Right. So that's kind of interesting that, you know, we always talk about director's cut, and, you know, I've been going on about how I appreciate what George Lucas was trying to do, but I don't appreciate what he did to the movies that I love, which are Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi. But director's cut came from Blade Runner, surprisingly. And also that Hampton Fancher, one of the screenwriters of the original movie, also is one of the screenwriters in this new redo of Blade Runner as well. So,
I think the director's cut is kind of an interesting thing, because I didn't realize it was simultaneously that old and that new. And it kind of makes sense that something as popular as a Blade Runner and a director with as much clout as a Ridley Scott would be able to push that sort of thing. Like, hey, we're going to have this other version of the movie. And I guess it coincides kind of nicely with being able to, you know, put it back in theaters or sell new copies of the movie that I don't think would have been as common back then. And certainly it's a lot more common now to have, like, like they already pre-planned these things, right? You'll see like, oh, available on iTunes, Justice League. And then, you know, a few months later, oh, Justice League Ultimate Edition with 34 more minutes. And it's got, you know, a couple of extras and so on and so forth. So it's definitely was a different world back then.
Right. Well, but to counter your point, though, I don't think he did have that much clout, because if you remember, the studio made him go in and put a happy ending at the end of the movie, and also have the voiceover part where Harrison Ford had to come back in and read the voiceover parts to sort of explain what the story was about. And I think a lot of people will say the director's cut without the narration is a much better movie, and without the happy ending at the end, right? Same thing happened to Brazil with Terry Gilliam. He fought the studio for a long, long time to try and get them to release the movie the way he wanted it done, right? And he stood his ground, but he kind of won the day at the end of it. But I mentioned that, you know, it was kind of a novelty to kind of search for this after the director's cut came out, because you really couldn't find copies of the original version with narration, the theatrical release as it's known now. But it's on that box set that I think I have a DVD. Jonathan has the Blu-rays, right? Yep. And yours has the 7. I have 6 or something like that, or 5, or however many movies there are. But it's an interesting term, director's cut. I mean, they even went back and redid Apocalypse Now, and you know, they've done it to some pretty seminal movies. I mean, you know, we don't go back and remake To Kill a Mockingbird or colorize it.
Well, let's not get into To Kill a Mockingbird. They kind of did a remake on that a couple of years ago. Which
did they really?
Well, they released the first one of the earlier drafts as to set a watchman, go set a watchman.
Really?
Which was a New York Times bestseller, but it really changed a lot of context, and it was clearly an earlier work. And boy, you know, I had some reservations about that as a huge fan of Harper Lee's work. I had a real tough time with sort of taking something that was unpublished, right, probably for a reason, and doing that.
Actually, I misspoke. I wasn't thinking of To Kill a Mockingbird. I was thinking of the other one that what's his name? Sam Spade movie. Maltese Falcon. Yeah, Maltese Falcon. To Kill a Mockingbird, Maltese Falcon. You can see it.
They're birds. Right? I got it. I'm with you.
They're black and white movies. Yeah.
Right?
Okay, they're old.
Yeah. It's a funny thing about the Blade Runner movie, too, because they, you know, in the same way that we all kind of turned our back on 1966 Batman when 1989 Batman came along, a lot of people sort of turned on the original cut of Blade Runner after the director's cut came out there and it was a little more graphic and stuff. I still have a little bit of a sweet spot for that original. You know, that's the first time I saw it. That's what I saw. And, you know, I don't feel diminished. I agree with you that the director's cut is a better version, but, no.
Actually, the final cut is a better version.
Yes, that's true. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Anywho, all right, let's move on.
But the last thing we should mention that somewhat follow up is the trailer has come out, the official trailer for Star Wars: The Last Jedi, and tickets became available. It was an ever loving mess to try to purchase them. By the time people listen to this episode, they'll probably have to be scrambling for those, you know, 1 p.m. showings, like in the middle of the day or something. But it's there. You can go check it out. It's a pretty interesting trailer. I think it definitely sets the mood for the movie, and maybe in a future episode we'll explore it a little bit more, but for the time being we'll just link to it in the show notes.
Sure. Yeah, Jonathan and I got our tickets. Did you get tickets yet, Jaime?
I did, for like 7 p.m. on Thursday, I think.
Yeah, same. I think, well, we're 7 p.m. but and we're not, you know, dead center as we like to be, but you know,
yeah,
I'll live with it.
We did get IMAX though, so that's a win.
That's a good thing. Yeah for sure.
Now is your 7 p.m. the same as our 7 p.m. Jaime? I'm not sure.
So this will be a pro tip for everybody out there. The East Coast will start prior to everybody else. And I don't know, they might do like the premiere thing in London, like they did with The Force Awakens. So I highly recommend people just stop using the internet, at least for social media concerns that day.
Well, it starts in Australia, actually, probably, right? Like Australia gets it way before us. They're 12 hours ahead of us.
Assuming their release date is the same. Sometimes they stagger those things, but it's possible.
Right.
I think they got it actually before us.
I regularly remember hearing from some of our friends down in, I have a few friends on one of the Slack groups I belong to that are down in Australia, and I remember them mentioning the movie at the time. So
nice.
Yeah, if you have a Slack group, you have to create a room for Star Wars to make it fair for everybody else so that you don't spill the beans in the main room. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sort of an unwritten rule of Slack. All right, so we move on to our discussion about the episode. Which episode are we in here?
This would be episode 4 of Star Trek Discovery. The Butcher's Knife cares not for the Lamb's Cry.
Right, and just before I jump into that, I just want to make a note here that we talked about there being 8 episodes before the break for, I don't know what the break for, but apparently I heard yesterday that they are going to release 9 episodes before the break. They the story arcs in such a way that they figured they can do 9 episodes before the cliffhanger. And they've already spilled the beans, so there's going to be a cliffhanger. Surprise, surprise, right?
Yeah, that's an interesting change. I didn't look at the calendar to see what that change in the break is, but I guess they must have decided it was okay that it doesn't slam into, like, you know, Christmas holidays sort of thing.
Yeah, he didn't say what it was, but one of the showrunners or show writers was saying this, and they sort of figured that from in terms of how the story arc was working, they could do 9 episodes instead of 8, and thus they decided to have the extra episode. So bonus for us. Anyway, I just want to, before we, so a couple things I noticed from the and I picked these up from After Trek, or that was called After Trek, yeah. So we have some new characters that we saw on the bridge during the first run of the clone, or was it called Spore Drive, right? We have a new character, Lieutenant Kayla Detmer, who's a human. She's the comm officer with the little implant on above her left eye, played by Emily Coates. We have Commander Arame, which is an augmented alien. She looks like she's wearing earphones and stuff like that. She's a Spore Drive's operator. It's played by Sarah Mitich. Lieutenant Junior Grade is somebody. I didn't get the name down. Oh, that's odd. Sorry about that. Another ops character, and Lieutenant Milton Richer, human, who's a comms officer, sort of takes the Uhura place, which is kind of flipping the tables there, I guess, played by Christopher Russell. So some notes on that. So what do you have to say about the show there, Hami? Episode 4?
It was kind of an interesting, what would you even call it, like a transitional episode, perhaps? Kind of transitioning away from the pilot, or the both pilots, if you want to call them both that, into, okay, here's how this thing works. I mean, they get the Spore Drive working by use of their friend, the Ripper, or Ripper, I guess, as they named the tardigrade thing, that what we've been calling the Kitty before. They set up some things with the Klingon side, with Volk's sort of his crew and everything with that. And
By the way, we forgot to say spoiler warning for people. We're going to talk about episode 4 of Discovery, and we're going to talk about the episode 5, I believe, of Orville. So spoiler warning. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Carry on.
Yeah, and it showed some interesting things to us. Like, it's not really like a plot point per se, but I found it kind of interesting that the design of the Discovery and how different that ship is from, let's say, you know, the Constitution class Enterprise that we've known, or any of the other ones. It has that sort of weird ring thing going, and it turns out that's actually important to the way it functions when it does the Spore Drive jumps. It sort of like rotates parts of the ship, and they sort of I don't know, it kind of reminded me of the effect from Harry Potter when they apparate and they sort of like spin into like nothingness and then sort of unspin, corkscrew out the other side. Did anybody sort of get that feeling?
Yeah, I think so.
That was a bizarre effect. That was I was a little caught a little off guard when the whole ship started rotating and twisting and gyrating. That was a very unusual scene.
Yeah, so I think the basic premise of this episode was that Captain Lorca has said, hey, we need to be able to weaponize this thing, because the Ripper that we mentioned, because it's got these claws that can just cut through steel like it's nothing, and phasers don't do anything to it. And so we can take those bits of technology and incorporate them, or bits of biology, and incorporate them somehow to our technology that might be yet another thing we can use for the war. And so he sets, I forget her position, but Landry, what's her name? Is that her actress name, Rekha Sharma?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, cool. Sorry, I'm also reading the notes. And Michael Burnham to, you know, try to discover what's going on with this thing. And Michael Burnham discovers, like,
well, to weaponize it.
Well, to weaponize aspects of its biology, right? Like, they realize, hey, you've got this material that its claws are made out of, and you've got this material that its like armor is made out of. And they thought maybe that would be useful, but as it turns out, it's really kind of more like a, what did they say, a tardigrade? Like those little, water animals, but just like huge version of that. And that it's not a predator. It just responded to things in a fight or flight kind of mode. And that it actually, like, really doesn't want to hurt anything, right? It happens to be powerful, but that's not, like, its whole reason for living. And yes, as you kind of funnily put here, I'm going to call her Lieutenant because I can't remember her rank. Lieutenant Landry decides to get a little impatient, does all sorts of bad things, and ends up being mauled to death by Ripper. And at some point here in the episode, I noted that they end up figuring out that all this equipment that they pulled off of the Glenn, the USS Glenn, the one that ran into the troubles in the previous episode, it actually has something to do with the Ripper, right? Like they kind of put the pieces together in the episode. It's like, well, we know these components is something that they were using, but they kind of really needed this like supercomputer in order to do all these sort of calculations that somehow tell you how you can navigate the, what do you call it? Like a spore web, spore network, for lack of a better term. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Michael Burnham figures out, like, wait a minute, like this thing was freaking out when we started using the spores. Maybe there's some sort of connection. And through a couple of different series, she figures out that, oh, like there actually is a biological connection between the spores and the tardigrade. And they, I guess, realize, like, wait a minute, these little like arm thingies that they were hanging onto for their spore drive, maybe they can use those as a way to sort of trigger the sort of calculation that they might want from the creature. And they do, right? They sort of put it in like this, I don't know, it's like a harness that looks like it's like poking it with pain sticks or something. It was really unclear to me what was happening, but it didn't look comfortable, that's for sure. And it does allow them to do successful jumps, which they really desperately needed, because I think we move right past this point, but around this time, they get a message from a Starfleet admiral saying, hey, this dilithium processing center, mining center, I forget what they called it, is under attack by the Klingons. And oh, by the way, that has like 40% of our output. So we're going to be hosed in this war if the Klingons take over that outpost. So they need somebody. And surprise, surprise, the Discovery is like the only one that's even vaguely close to help defend that thing. So that was sort of like the main thrust and setup for trying to discover how they could deal with the spore drive and also the tardigrade at the same time.
Yeah. So of course, you know, Rekka gets damaged and they rush her off to sick bay, the beamer to sick bay, actually, which I don't remember them doing on the original series either. But I just love the fact that the sound of the sick bay had the same sort of klaxon noises that McCoy's sick bay has in the original series. So another throwback there, audio clue. That's some interesting things to us. Well, we can talk more about the episode. So what do you think?
I think we've skipped over the most interesting part of the episode, which I can't believe I'm saying this because I'm not a fan so far of the new style of Klingon, but they ate Captain Georgiou.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
can we go back and talk about how they ate Captain Georgiou?
Yeah. I can't remember. The two of them were talking about it.
Yeah, that's some grim, you know, that's some grim Star Trek. That might be the farthest they've pushed that boundary so far.
That's true.
Yeah, and it was mentioned in a throwaway line too, right? Because the premise for the Klingon side of the story was that after the battle, Vok's ship, you know, Takuvma's old ship, is sort of just left there and they're damaged in such a way that they can't, you know, move around under their own power. So they're on, you know, emergency power, and they're eating rations and stuff, but they're slowly starving to death. And I guess they've been sitting there for 6 months, given that's how long the war has been going on. And I think her name is Terrell. I don't know if I wrote her name down correctly. She's one of the female Klingons is talking to Vok about, like, hey, you know, the Senjou is available and it's got a dilithium processing unit that we can use to help power our ship. And Vok's like, no, Takuvma never would have liked that because it's bringing the Federation, in this case, impurity into our, you know, purity of Klingonhood, Klingondom. And she's like, dude, look, it doesn't matter if we're dead, right? Like, it's not practical to go that far with it. And she throws that, you know, throwaway line of like, oh, you didn't really consider that impure when we, you know, when you picked the flesh or bones or something from the captain, you know, referencing Georgiou.
So it was like skull. I think he's, yeah, bones off her skull.
Yeah, peeling her skull. Yeah.
Meat off her skull. Yes. Oh my, what an image.
Yeah. In a throwaway line, we learned that one of the characters that we saw in the premiere was eaten apparently by the Klingons.
Yeah. That's a pretty, that might be the all-time ignominious end for a Star Trek character. They had some pretty bad deaths of those red shirts, but getting shot and eaten by the nouveau Klingons. Wow. That's grim.
Right.
Reminds me of the Twilight Zone episode, To Serve Man.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess to recap that part of the Klingon story, eventually Terrell convinces Vok that they should go over to the Senjou. They go over, they take the dilithium processing unit out. But when they return to the ship, one of the other Klingons, and I forget his name, I didn't write it down, I didn't catch it, but the one who clearly didn't like Takuvma and didn't didn't believe in any of that, you know, any of what he was selling, has not only come on board that ship, but has also apparently brought rations to get the crew to essentially mutiny and join his own sort of clan rather than rolling around with the remnants of Takuvma's sort of like religious sect. And they were going to kill him, Voke in this case I was talking about, but Tyrell tells him, well, it would actually be more of a fitting end if we were to leave him to die on the Senjo. And so they send him over there to ostensibly die, and the ship warps away. I forget what that ship was called, but you know, Takuvma's old ship. And who should be there? But Tyrell has apparently taken some sort of shuttlecraft or something to and you know, scuttled away to go be with Voke. And she's like, hey, my clan, the Mokai clan, we got a way that we can help you, but it will require this grand sacrifice of yourself in order to get the, I don't know, the power, glory, whatever it may be that he will need in the future to bring the Klingons together. That's sort of the end of their storyline for this particular episode.
Yep.
Apparently our bad guy Klingon, who is now in charge again, is Cole, K-O-L, Cole?
Yeah,
Cole. Right.
And Lorel, L'Rell, Lorel.
Lorel was her name? Okay.
Lorel, yes.
Well, okay, wow, so I definitely wrote it wrong in my notes.
Yeah. That's okay. You could be forgiven because those scenes, boy, that's the part of the episode that are still struggling through, man. Wow. I mean, I get that there's probably like 100 guys in their mom's basement who are really excited that they're doing the whole scene for like 15 minutes an episode in full Klingon, but wow, those are hard watches.
Like I said, I'm waiting for the Universal Translator to come be invented.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know why they can't do the Christopher Lloyd circa Star Trek 3 where they just zoom in and all of a sudden he's speaking a different language, you know?
Right.
I get it. I assume they're speaking Klingonese if they are Klingons on a Klingon ship. I don't need to have that much grunting and slavering.
Yeah, one of my favorite movies is, you know, the 13th Warrior or something like that, 13 Warriors, where they're talking, I think they're Vikings, and there's one guy, he's from the Middle East, and he's joined them to go on this big quest. And somewhere in the middle, like, you know, they're off on the first part of the journey, and he's just kind of learning their language. And one day, all just in the middle of the scene, they start speaking English, which is to signify that he now understands what they're saying, right? And I thought that was really well done, the way they did that in that particular movie, right?
Yeah.
So they could certainly do that here, like you said. They start off in Klingon and then switch to English as the camera, you know, focuses in on them.
Yeah, I wouldn't feel like I was being cheated. And it would never occur to me that, or I would never take it for granted. They were like, well, of course we learned how to speak the language of our hated enemies for the scene.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's true. That's not to say that we'll be speaking English in 200 years, right?
Yeah, I think Firefly was a little closer, where it's a mishmash.
Mishmash, yeah, for sure.
Can I, have you guys had a chance to partake of the social media in the last couple of days after episode 4?
No, what was the reaction?
Yeah, I don't think I've seen social media reaction to it.
There was a fair bit of backlash on, I noticed it on Monday, over the fact that in 4 episodes they've managed to kill 2 minority characters and 2 women.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was Asian, South Asian Star Trek fandom was perhaps justifiably up in arms over the fact that, yeah, I mean, there's the old trope of killing women in science fiction, which is, you know, yes, that's absolutely fair. But the fact that they chose to have, you know, women who aren't necessarily, you know, North American white women in some of these prominent roles, and then killed 2 of them in you know, within 2 episodes of each other, definitely got a lot of backlash, and a lot of people were, you know, oh, it's great, we finally see an Indian woman represent. Oh, she's dead. Oh, Asian, she's the captain. Yeah. Oh, she's dead. So I think there was a little bit of a storm brewing on that one, where you know, some people were, you know, very blunt about their opinions on where that plot has gone so far. So we'll see. And the other thing that I really thought was great to see was you know, 2 gay characters. You know, we're set up for our first gay coupling in Star Trek. We have the the head of engineering and our new doctor. So making a little bit of progress there. Two steps back and 1 step forward. That's good.
Yeah, that's. I think I've seen. I guess I didn't see the social media reaction, but I saw the reaction to the reaction. I guess on some website I was reading some link where I guess the showrunners are explaining that Landry's character was originally originally written to be a white male, and for reasons that are a little bit unclear to me, they say, oh, well, we found this actress, why don't we have her play that role? I mean, on the one hand, that's great. It's like, hey, great, you know, you added some diversity to the cast. But on the other, you think they'd have somebody sitting there saying, wait a minute, are we adding a minority and then we're killing them off immediately? Like, that makes it worse.
For the second time in two episodes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's just unfortunate timing.
Yeah, it's definitely a bummer. Like, I think from the diversity standpoint, there's only so far you can go on having a main character be a minority and then also having another main character be a minority. Like, it's going to be a tricky one to play, because otherwise, from what I remember of the cast, it's largely an all-white cast, and it's something I think they should consider for future casting, hopefully. Yeah. And not to like tokenize, but just to say, wait a minute, what exactly are we doing here? Because you don't want that to be front and center. You want the story to be front and center.
Yeah. Right. And we've gone from having a ship that was on the Shenzhou, where there was, you know, two women in the top two roles, to, you know, hey, we've got a, you know, onto this ship, and now we've got two males. We'll assume that the first officer is male. But we sort of flipped the script back to the old way again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting stuff. This is not a follow-up thing, but I was speaking with the man, those little badges that did you get one of those badges from Quantum Drive, Jaime?
I haven't, and I was thinking of getting one of the pins, I think, the small enamel pin style.
Well, I was chatting with the manufacturer, I guess the guy who's in charge of deciding what they do on our Twitter account, and I sort of said, as soon as I saw the black badges, I thought they would be really cool, kind of cool, and he said he had the same thought, so they might actually be coming out with a black badge sometime in the future. So that'd be kind of cool. You know, the special ops ones,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The polished black. And just something else to notice, you probably saw it in the opening credits, but this is NCC 1031, which is kind of significant in terms of how they name the ships and stuff like that, right? And then from the after Trek, there was a short little bit on by a lady named Gersha Phillips, whose her title is Suiting and Booting, and she's in charge of making the costumes. And she talked a bit about the costumes, the different colors: gold for command, silver for science, copper for operations, and white for medical. And the fabric, she said, has a four-way stretch sort of thing. And they were asked to put the sort of gold color or the metallic panels on the sides for interest. And they wanted something that made them look like superheroes. And what's interesting, too, is that in the beginning of this episode, we see our hero, Michael Burnham. Her outfit is being made in her replicator in her room, I guess, for her. And apparently the replicator first appeared on The Next Generation Star Trek, so they didn't have replicators. I mean, they had a little, you know, almost like the sandwich shop affair that they had in the original series, but you never saw the actual food being manufactured like you do in the replicator, right?
So that was something I was kind of wondering about, and maybe we'll need some fact checking either live or after the fact in a future episode. You're right that the replicator was a TNG thing, but didn't they have something called a synthesizer that sounds very similar, but presumably
but they never really technology. they didn't have the special effecty kind of thing. They had like a little, you walked up to this thing, you pushed a button and a door would open up, like a bread box door would open up, and you would pull up the tray with the food on it. And that was, I guess that was their version of the replicator. It kind of magically, food would magically appear, but you know.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if it was, you know, to try to reconcile, you know, 50 some years of differences. I assume in my mind that like the replicator is essentially largely magic. It can create anything in the world except apparently pressed latinum. Monetary currency and like Deep Space Nine in particular. And the synthesizer, I assumed, was a lot more similar to our 3D printers now, where, you know, maybe you have one that 3D prints food, but that's literally all it can do. And the other one that, you know, makes clothing, can make clothing, but it can't make, you know, laptops. It can't make, you know, replacement body parts, you know, that sort of thing. I'm guessing that's what the difference is, because the intro to the episode was kind of interesting, where they show this like lightning storm and all these geometric shapes, these, you know, very hard edge shapes kind of coming together and growing like Christmas crystalline structure style, and it becomes the uniform. It's kind of an interesting special effect, but it did make me think of like a future 3D printer, as opposed to the replicator saying, oh, I can just move atoms around at will, and it's totally cool, instead of this plastic that I'm just squirting around, and it hardens and becomes a uniform.
Yeah. So we were like, it looked like a storm of some type. It was supposed to be meant to be looking at a microscopic level, right? So that's kind of interesting. So
I'm not sure how they got that one past the safety board for the ship, but this thing's going to have exposed lightning, and every cabin has one. It's going to be fine.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like static electricity at that level, I guess, right? So
I hope so.
Yeah. Well, you kind of wonder how do they outfit the crew? You know, well, clearly they replicate their uniforms, right? So
yeah,
makes it easy.
And I guess one thing we should mention, because, or at least I want to mention related to the episode, because I assume thematically it'll become more important throughout the series. But I think I also want to address a plot point that I think a lot of people thought was a plot hole. But when you really think about it, there's a pretty easy answer. So during the episode, the last will and testament of Captain George
presented.
You know, it's like a duffel bag, like a space duffel bag that, you know, you have to assert that I accept this thing. And Michael Burnham is at the beginning of the episode, like, not ready for it. And having, what did we say her name was? Lily, the cadet, having her around was like making it worse. But by the end of the episode, finally accepted and moved on and said, all right, I'm going to go ahead and take this. And there's a message, a holographic message from Captain Trishot that is kind of sad, because it clearly was recorded with, you know, happier times between them, where the assumption was that by the time she gets this, that Michael Burnham will have become a captain and have her own ship. Of course, none of that happened. And she passes along this artifact that has been an heirloom in her family for centuries. And it turns out to be a telescope. That's something I think that will play sort of going further into, you know, the episodes, that sort of thinking back to times under Giorgio and like, you know, what would she do sort of things is what I assume is going to happen there. But I want to address the plot point where people were like, oh, well, wasn't that like on the San Joe and how did it get there? I was like, wait, hold on. Think about this. Have you ever put anything in a safe deposit box at a bank? Like, my car explodes with me in it. I mean, that's really sad, but it's not as if I'm carrying around the last will and testament and heirlooms I'm going to pass down to my heirs. Like, I have it in a safe place. So upon
Hang on. That telescope, the both of them were looking through when they were looking in the beginning of the first episode.
Was it the same exact one? That's what I was unclear about.
Yeah, I believe it was meant to be.
It looks the same.
If you even go back, you know, they have the sort of recap of this is what happened before. I just watched it just before we started recording here, and the first scene is Michael Burnham looking through the telescope the captain's ready room.
Same one, like all scratched up and everything? Because the one...
I don't know. Maybe they made a couple of them.
Well, it kind of got scratched up when they got shot at by a lot of Klingons, too.
That's true. And singed.
right. I assumed it was age, but yeah, I guess maybe I thought, it was not the same one. And we'd have to like...
Those aren't sand people check. Blasters.
Or, I don't know, maybe it's like the sort of thing that's in the captain's emergency escape pod sort of thing. So,
you quick, know, grab my telescope and get in the shuttle.
Yeah, quick, let me record my last will and testament.
Don't worry, I'm sure they won't eat our skulls. What could go wrong?
Exactly. All right, let's move on to the Orville, since we have a few more minutes before we have to wrap this up. What do you think about the episode called Priya? Well, I think the connection here is from the, what is it called again? Live and Die in the West, or How to Laugh in the West, or something.
A Million Ways to Die in the West.
Starring Charlize Theron and our hero, right?
Yep, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And they made actually a pretty good couple in that film. And there's clearly some chemistry between the two of them in this episode. I think they actually work well together.
Hmm. Yeah, I thought it was a fun episode. It had some sort of TNG feels to it, you know, both figuratively and literally.
I missed the Mr. Potato Head thing. What was that reference about?
That was when
practical joking between Gordon and Isaac. But
yeah, that was when Isaac sort of walks into the bridge and everybody's staring at him, wondering why he's got these Mr. Potato Head parts, much larger than, you know, than the normal toy would be, but it clearly intended to be Mr. Potato Head. But he's got these parts on his head, and he apparently doesn't notice that they're there, and it turns out that when he was recharging or whatever the equivalent is of a sleep, Gordon, you know, put those things on him, and it revealed some more about him, right? That those blue eyes that we see are actually more just like like superfluous LEDs that are meant for like our benefit to give us
kind
of space to appear more humanoid. And instead, that's not the way it works. Like he, you know, uses sensors like a robot probably would, right? It wouldn't necessarily need optical units in a particular place, just like we have. And that led to them discussing the whole nature of practical jokes, and that he should get Gordon back. And he does by amputating his leg during his sleep, which was rather horrifying to think about.
But he does end up earning the grudging respect of Gordon for perhaps the most epic practical joke in the history of their spaceship.
It's really hard to top that one, right? Like that's like the ultimate one that you could do.
And the leg, of course, making its grand reappearance at one point just to break the tension in an otherwise tense scene, falling from the ceiling is priceless.
So in this one, Charlize Theron, as mentioned, plays Captain Priya Levesque, who is ostensibly a mining ship captain, and she gets in danger, and the Orville's the only ship close by, so they go save her. And immediately, is it Kelly, the XO, is just like not having it, right? She's feeling, I think because of that chemistry between Priya and Captain Mercer, she's already feeling kind of not cool because that's like her ex-husband and she obviously still has feelings for him. But she notices that there's like some weirdness about her, and she convinces Alara to, you know, violate the rules, and they go investigate this woman's room on board the ship. And they discover this weird metallic brick that they don't know what it does. Comedy happens. They run into a dark matter storm, in which case Priya says, by the way, I know this cool trick. By the way, let's do this. Was it like a baryon beam or some other techie sounding, you know, particle beam sweep that Isaac is like, oh, that's interesting. I haven't really heard of that one, you know, and he's from like a super advanced technology society, right? And they hadn't really thought of that, but it didn't seem unreasonable to him, and they do it, and she pilots them through the whole thing. And it turns out that she's actually a antique dealer from the future, and they found this wormhole that can get them back through time. And she deals in things that would not impact the timeline. And in this case, we discover that the Orville was supposed to be destroyed and everybody was supposed to be dead. So it doesn't really matter from her perspective that why don't I pluck it from the timeline, bring it to the future, sell it to, you know, this weird alien buyer, and the crew can go live on their lives in the future. And it's cool. And I thought that was kind of interesting as a setup, because it felt kind of like a TNG setup to me. And it also brought in some technology that we had talked about. Like we talked about the fact that they don't have transporters in the Orville show, but apparently in the 29th century where Priya's from, they do have it. She teleports herself right under the bridge during one of the scenes when they're taking over the Orville and trying to take it through the wormhole. And there's some really cool sort of like special effects while they're doing that that I really enjoyed.
What's his comment about Isaac died? I must have missed that part.
So I need to rewatch the episode, because when they're trying to when they're trying to disable the little silver brick that she has, the little metallic brick that Priya has the ship and over in engineering, they use a diamond tip drill to like drill some holes through the casing. And then they have Isaac try to use his, we saw this in the previous episodes where he has like little, I don't know, robotic tendrils that come out of his hand that, you know, I guess he like R2-D2 style connects to other things. It's like his USB port sort of thing. And he gets some sort of like feedback shock electric thing that like ostensibly kills him, right? Like the chief engineer comes over, it's like, oh my god, there's like no activity in his systems, he's dead. And I sort of missed the nuance here, but it comes out later on that he has transferred his consciousness over to the ship, because he uses a reference to the Seinfeld episode within the little communications terminal that's on the captain's chair to say like, hey, would you like a junior mint, captain, which is a reference to the Seinfeld episode they were watching at the very beginning of the episode that was the whole reason for them to talk about comedy. And it was a little unclear to me if that was like his iCloud backup, or if he had like, you know, when you move a file from like your local disk to like, you know, some sort of cloud storage, if that was what happened. That was the part that went a little too fast for me to catch exactly the nuance of what happened there.
Yeah, I think think what I think they mentioned that he that they did that as a ruse in case she was monitoring them. I think that they a concoction. They were trying to throw her off the trail in case she thought they were trying to do some kind of trickery, which they clearly were. So
okay. So they'd set it up there so that he would be out of his own body at the time that occurred. At the time the crazy feedback happened. Okay.
Yep. Yeah, you're right. It was very very much like a sort of Star Trek-y kind of wormhole time traveling episode where, you know, they have these kind of conundrums. Yeah.
And they end up destroying the wormhole, which leads to some sort of interesting possibilities as to what happens with time, because there's a standoff between Priya and Mercer where she's like, look, you were supposed to die. You can come live in the future. Everything's much better. If you destroy the wormhole, then I'll have never been able to come back here. And you're basically just going to be like that dude who's still hung up over his ex-wife. Do you want to be that loser? he takes her transporter, like her little, I don't know, gadget, and he puts it in his desk. So we can't actually see what happens to that. But she disappears when they destroyed the wormhole, right? Sort of implying that, oh, she was never actually able to go back. But the look on his face implies to me that this crew still remembers what happened. So I'm a little unclear as to how the mechanics of the sort of timeline change works.
Well, do they remember what happens? Or because we never do see that at the very end of it. They destroy it. I would assume that the transporter thing would disappear as well as her, right?
It'd be interesting to see if that pops up in a future episode, because...
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I think that has to be a kind of... If you see him put it in a drawer, you kind of think it's going to make a comeback at some point.
It's Marty McFly's girlfriend sleeping on the front porch between Back to the Future 2 and Back to the Future 3.
Yeah.
But I think it was very purposeful that they showed him putting it in the drawer so we couldn't see what happened, to leave the writers use it. Because they could have just had it on the desk and, you know, she could have disappeared and it could have disappeared at the same time. They could have done the same effect. So we'll end up seeing what ends up happening with that.
Yep. Then we'll start yelling and screaming at the TV.
I'm sure there'll be a lot of discussions on Reddit that will be like, well, this is how it could happen. But then you start getting into weird things like, you know, if you start analyzing the finale of TNG, All Good Things, as to, well, could the Pasteur and the Enterprise really have seen that stuff if time's supposed to work backwards for the anti-time thing? So good fodder for discussion online, I think.
Yeah. Right, let's leave that there. Let's look at some of the things we want to see in the next little bit. So you've got three things here, Jaime. In your tradition of having one pick, you've put three down here, which is great.
They all happened to come out. One was the YouTube trailer for a series that you had told us about, the Philip K. Dick's Electric Dreams, which is an anthology series that's going to be coming out on Amazon Video relatively soon. So it looks pretty cool. It has a lot of people you'll recognize. Bryan Cranston is probably the biggest star I happened to notice when they showed some of their previous scenes. So if you're interested...
That's quite a few stars. So is this going to come out all at once on Amazon Video, or is it going to come out in... Do they release them in... Because here it's going to be on the Space Channel, the same station that's showing the Star Trek stuff. But are they going to release these all at once on Amazon, do you think?
I don't know for certain, but given the way that Amazon has tended to release all of its episodes at once for a season, the way that they do on the Netflix side of things, I'm going to guess they'll probably release them all at once. But it would not surprise me if they did it Discovery style, where they do one per week, you know, sort of stretch it out a little bit.
And they did, Amazon did do that with their version of Top Gear Grand Tour. They did that week by week, and they actually split up the season of The Tick, which is actually a lot of fun. They actually split that into two chunks, so they have a couple of different models they might take with that.
Mm-hmm. So The Tick is on Amazon Video. All right, I have to go over there and watch that then. And the next one you have here, Hamid?
The next one I have is a sequel. This is the official trailer for Pacific Rim Uprising. You might have remembered this film a couple of years ago. It was essentially an unbranded Neon Genesis Evangelion, where people in big robots fight big monsters, kaiju in their parlance here. This takes place some, I think, unspecified time, and I might be wrong, maybe they said in the trailer, but this essentially follows the son for Idris Elba's character. And apparently the kaiju are back, and I'm going to eat popcorn and watch big robots smack monsters in the face with, you know, building pieces and their crazy swords, and they're probably going to pick up, you know, more battleships and or cruise ships and stuff and smack things in the face. So it'll be a lot of fun, I hope.
Oh, that's the point of that movie. I didn't get through the first one at all. I just halfway through, I just kind of went, this is pointless. But I guess it's a thing. I guess in reminiscent of the old Godzilla and all those kind of Japanese Ultraman and that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, you sit back, you you get your popcorn, and this is sort of thing you do after you've had like a long, rough day, and just I'm sure there'll be some plot. I'm sure it may or may not make sense, but boy, oh boy, will it be fun to watch the action scenes.
Yeah, and that is why they invented 3D movie going, to watch giant monsters battle giant robots. I'm with you, Jaime. I like that movie. I thought it was a lot of fun. It was just exactly what you need with a big bag of popcorn. It's just silly, over the top, you know, the best of that stuff. And apparently it was set in 2025, so the not distant future we could have Jaegers.
Oh, right.
Is there a waiting list? Can I get on a waiting list? Is it like an iPhone release? Can I get a Jaeger?
It's like a Tesla, probably.
That's it. I think Elon Musk is working on Jaegers right now, so we could get those.
And you got one more there, Jaime? We'll move on to Jonathan's.
The last one here is Replicas, a movie that is, this is the movie trailer for a movie coming out starring Keanu Reeves, which in the pre-show we're describing its similarity in some respects to, did we say Surrogates?
Surrogates
film,
yeah.
Right, where, oh my gosh, from Die Hard, Bruce Willis is, you know, is in a society where people sort of live virtual lives, you know, connected into like a Matrix type thing and remotely controlling, you know, avatars, robots, bodies that live in real society. In this case, it's kind of...
Replica movies is completely different because it's Keanu Reeves, not Bruce Willis, right?
Yeah. It's sort of like the reverse mode where he's sort of researching like how to transfer human consciousness. So it kind of reminds me of Transcendence, I want to say it is. And a little bit of Pet Cemetery in here where, you know, he's working on his technology. His wife and kids are, you know, killed in a car wreck of some sort, and he transfers their consciousness into these android bodies. And thereon goes the plot. And people have joked and said, like, maybe this is like a prequel to John Wick, if you've ever seen that action movie where his wife is killed. But it seems like it could be interesting, at least from what I saw on the trailer. I didn't see any obvious warning signs, so something to be excited about, perhaps.
Yeah. So, Jonathan, you got something for us this week?
I do. As we talked about last week, I'm digging into the new comics pile for you, and I have a recommendation. The issue of Savage Dragon, we talked about Savage Dragon last week in the corrections. So Savage Dragon comic book that's been going on for a very long time, 20 years-ish, from Image Comics. The creator, Eric Larson, was here in town for Fan Expo Canada in the beginning of September. And his new issue is set in Toronto. And he made some headlines last month. Issue 226 had Donald Trump on the front cover. He was demanding that all the aliens get out of America. And in this case, he means literal aliens as opposed to figurative or illegal aliens, as he's been known to target. So in this latest issue of Savage Dragon, they decide to pack up and move to Toronto. The dragon and his girlfriend and the kids. So they pack up and they hit the border. And so it's a whole very funny look at, you know, a clash of American and Canadian culture. They're freaked out about the metric system. They discover Labatt's Blue, and there's a great line. They eat at Burger's Priest, of course, as you should if you're going to come to Toronto. They make a big joke about the fact that the giant space needle-ish looking building, which is of course the CN Tower, and how it probably has a very overrated and expensive rotating restaurant at the top, which well, yeah.
Wait, does your version have that too?
Yes, it does. It does. But again, it's just a fun trip, especially for people who are familiar with Toronto. There's lots of little references and jokes, lots of little tidbits in there. And clearly Mr. Larson had a very good time when he was in Toronto, because it helped inspire his latest book. And you should definitely pick it up. Image Comics, it's out next week for the low price of $4.
That's not bad.
Cool. And the issue that's before, if you're not a fan of the U.S. president, the issue before is a delightful satire. Eric Larson has always set his Savage Dragon comics in the contemporary world. So he had Obama in the past. He's had George W. Bush. He's had lots of cameos in real world events. And of course, Trump was just too tantalizing a target for him not to include him in the book. And of course, that leads to this.
So. I guess so. Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess that's it for this week. So, hey, Jaime, if people want to get a hold of you on interwebs, wherever they look.
I'm on Twitter as @devwithahair.
Right. And Jonathan, if people want to find you.
I am at @jpknews and jpkcomics.com.
All right. And as I said at the top of the show, I am Timitra, T-I-M-M-I-T-R-A on the Twitter machine. And that's how you get a hold of me. All right. So we'll see you guys next week. Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye. Bye. Bye.
If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the Spockcast website at spockcast.com. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter @Spockcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the #AskSpockcast. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/Spockcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.
Oh, is that the new? That's the new, Bruce Willis knockoff, right?
Oh, yeah. I can see why you say that. What was the name of that movie? Yeah. Where they like all live like
replicas? Lives, right?
they're like
Simulacrum or something like that. I don't know.
They all have like these virtual bot. I mean, they have like robot bodies that they virtually connect to.
Yeah, that was a good movie. I like that one. That was let's get the IMDb database going here.
Sorry, what movie? I had to start. Surrogates.
Surrogates, yeah, that's it.
I wasn't even here for the conversation. I nailed it.
I know. He just totally like. Well, that's what I sort of said when I saw this replicas thing. I thought Bruce Willis, you know, knockoff already, right?
Yeah. To be fair, you and I could get Bruce Willis to be in a movie. So you know,
what's that?
For like $10 million, you can get Bruce Willis to be in any movie at this point.
Oh, really?
Collective. I think he's got I don't know, alimony payments or irresponsible children.
Right. He's got to put his kids through university. Hey, yeah. Are you like sitting close to your microphone?
I'm not because I'm trying to figure out this push. Mike, I've got it downloaded, but it
won't. All right. Do. See, you got me doing it now.
Let's see here. Looking at your notes. Implausible central plot point made plausible.
Have you seen the movie yet?
I have not seen the movie, no.
Oh, good. So Jonathan and I get to talk about it without spoiling a single thing. That's going to be really
fun. Is that even possible? Because there was something...
It is possible,
there was something in the news today about, like, I guess it didn't open that well.
Really?
Oh, it didn't.
Oh.
And they were like, well, maybe it's because we didn't spoil every darn plot point like the way every other movie does. And
yeah, I don't know. I don't know if they did that necessarily. It was good. I mean, think about it. I was thinking about what you said last week about your girlfriend having not seen the original Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. I don't know that you necessarily need to see the original Blade Runner to get the whole thing.
I think it stands up pretty well by itself. I think it was an enjoyable science fiction movie. Compared to something like episodes.
Well, we'll have to talk when
all callbacks. Like I felt like Blade Runner at least was you didn't have to have seen every frame of the first one to just enjoy it as a film.
Yeah, no, it was a good film. I thought. Yeah, but you know, again, I'm not surprised. I mean, Blade Runner tanked at the box office the first time around.
Yeah,
and you're right; they totally hyped the hell out of it. Right.
To be fair, it did not tank. It won the box office. It was the highest grossing movie of the weekend. It just didn't.
Oh, did it really?
It didn't.
No. I mean, I'm talking about the original one.
No, the original one tanked. This one.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking. Yeah. About. Yeah. No, the original one did.
Well, look what it had to compete against: Tom Cruise and what else? It, which had been out for a few weeks, right?
Yeah. No, I mean,
the other mountain movie,
Less than $40 million, and they were expecting 50.
Anyway, we shouldn't be saying this when you're not leaning into the microphone.
Again, I keep turning my head to try and figure out this. I can't figure out this app. I'll figure it out for next week.
Don't worry about it.
I'm trying not to cough deeply into this one.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Are you close to your mic now?
I am close to my mic now. Is that good?
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.